And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Good to have you along for our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area and the state's top journalists. And this week they are as follows. We'll introduce a newcomer first. He's with the News Service of Florida, which is a news source used by both newspapers and radio. David Royce, who joins us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Hi, Dave. Good to have you.
Hi, Phil. Thanks. Appreciate it. Good to be here.
Also with us here in the studio are a pair of hardworking Miami Herald business journalists. John Dorschner is with us. He's written for the Herald for too many years, more than he'd like to tell us. And in fact, next week is his last week at the Miami Herald. And boy, it couldn't have been a better week to have you on with all this Medicaid stuff. John, welcome to the panel again.
Good to be here.
And Hanna Sampson is a business writer with the Miami Herald, who last week, in fact, had three front page stories on the same day. She's been very busy lately covering travel, tourism, the cruise industry, all the things that have been happening there. And Hanna, it's good to have you back as well.
Thanks, Phil. It's good to be here.
And let's begin with this shameless plug, folks, because it is just 72 hours away. We are really looking forward to this effort and civic engagement. We'd like to thank everyone who has already RSVP'd to our town hall meeting on state legislative issues taking place this Monday at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts in Fort Lauderdale. We've got a pair of state lawmakers, Jack Latvala, the Republican from the Tampa Bay area, and Chris Smith, the Democratic leader from the South Florida area, from Fort Lauderdale. We have Marion Kloss from the Miami Herald that's coming along. We have a whole bunch of things that are happening surrounding the event with our staffers, with everybody involved, and we need you to be there. It's one of those things that we've been talking about for months, and now here it is. So if you've RSVP'd already, thank you so much. If you haven't done it, Monday evening at the Broward Center, please do at WLRN.org and help us make Tallahassee accountable. And this week, a lot of news from Tallahassee, and we'll begin right there with the Medicaid expansion. Governor Rick Scott has given in to the federal government, you could say, as he has called for an expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, also known as the once-evil Obamacare. Now it's up to lawmakers to decide, and Scott says he has asked legislative leaders for their support. That move did draw praise from Democrats, but has outraged many of Scott's more conservative backers. The governor, who is a former hospitals executive, has vehemently opposed federally run health care in the past.
But it doesn't matter what I believe. It doesn't matter what anybody believes. The Supreme Court's already made their decision. Okay, we had an election in the fall. Okay, the public made their decision. Now the president's health care law is the mandate's there. That's the law.
But he says he'll only support the three-year Medicaid expansion that would need to be reauthorized. Federal funding covers 100% of the costs during that 3 years.
And I think this is a common sense solution to dealing with this for the next 3 years, where it will give us the time to think about how we can improve the system.
John Dorschner, you are the preeminent healthcare expert here in South Florida with the Miami Herald. You've been writing about this topic for a very long time. First of all, how, if the legislature decides to go along, how would it affect the nearly 1 million Floridians here?
Well, there would be it would give insurance to about 1 million Floridians over a 10-year period. If they went with it for 10 years, the state would get about $26 billion in federal funds. Florida Hospital Association estimates that would add about 50,000 jobs, which Governor Scott has emphasized that he is a job creator. There is the Florida Hospital Association survey shows that more than 60% of Floridians favor the expansion. The hospital associations, the doctors favor it, so there's a lot of support for this.
And what would it mean for someone with Medicaid to be under managed care?
Well, managed care is what the state is going under, and that means that they would have to join a health, an HMO. And there's debate about how this works. When it started in Broward as pilot some years ago, there was a lot of chaos at the beginning and a lot of unhappy people. It has smoothed out since then, and the University of Florida indicates that the managed care has been doing better lately.
David Royce in Tallahassee, is this purely political yoga, if you will, or is the governor becoming a realist?
I think it might be a little of both. It certainly looks pragmatic. But, you know, this is a governor who ran on a, you know, a pretty ideological platform of anti-Obamacare. And so obviously those people in his party who identified with that and who voted for him feel betrayed. I think I saw the word traitor and Benedict Arnold and those kind of words thrown around a whole lot on Twitter the other day when the governor made his announcement. I think he certainly is, as he said, looking at this sort of pragmatically and realistically. Look, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled. President Obama was reelected. Obamacare is not going away. And I thought it was interesting that he said, you know, here's all this federal money out there and you know, other states are going to get it. And I couldn't in good conscience, not allow Floridians to have access to the health care that would pay for.
It reminds you that 2 years ago, his turning down the federal funds for the high-speed rail between Orlando and Tampa and some of the problems that he got into after that, and the money went elsewhere.
Right, and the outlying years, it's the same issue. I mean, you know, with getting rid of rail, he said, look, we don't know in the long term whether we're going to be on the hook to pay for this. That's the same issue that the, you know, the people who are now going to be his opponents on this issue have said, you know, after that 3 years, we don't know, you know, if the government's going to – what the federal government's going to pay for this, whether they're going to be able to pay for it, and whether Florida might be on the hook for enormous costs going forward down the road.
We said Democrats are applauding the decision at a Wednesday stop in Orlando. Actually, just before the announcement, here is a Florida Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson says it makes sense for Florida to participate in the overhaul of Medicaid.
The federal government is paying 100% of the cost for the next 3 years, and the max that the state of Florida would pay would be 10% of the total cost.
So there are six other Republican governors, including Ohio's Governor John Kasich, also in favor of doing this, expanding Medicaid. Legislative leaders, though, are more noncommittal. Here we heard Republican House Speaker Will Weatherford say in a statement he called the law inflexible and doubted it would improve health care quality. Here is Republican Senator John Thrasher, who praised the governor but said he would not predict how lawmakers would vote.
It's about leadership, and that's what the governor, I think, is showing on this. Now, that doesn't mean the legislature has to agree with everything he says, but I'm proud of his leadership.
And House Democratic Leader Perry Thurston of Fort Lauderdale says it would be wrong for lawmakers to prevent more Floridians from getting health care.
Morally reprehensible is the word that I would put there for us not to accept this and to expand and to provide the type of coverage that the citizens of the state of Florida need.
And we immediately heard from the Florida Hospital Association. John Dorschner, you've covered hospitals for a long time, and they've been pushing for this for a long time.
Well, it's a dollar and cents issue, and that is the federal law requires them to hospitals to treat anybody that goes into the emergency room. The emergency room has the most expensive care. If they're uninsured, the hospitals pay for that uninsured person in the ER, and then they pass along the cost to those of us who have private health insurance. So, you know, in a long run theoretical thing, this would help protect cost increases for private insurance by having more people with Medicaid.
And the largest example of a public hospital that could benefit from this is Jackson Health System of Miami, the largest public hospital in the state. Here is Edwin Odell, the corporate director of media relations.
Anything that provides coverage for our currently uninsured residents of Miami-Dade County certainly advances our community's health care and Jackson Health System's mission. Now, as far as the impact on Jackson's budget, it will be based on how the details are written and how the funding is allocated.
And a lot of people that go to Jackson and public hospitals are uninsured, right? What percentage and who would be eligible?
Well, roughly one-third of patients who walk into Jackson's hospital right now are uninsured. Some of those, they get qualified for Medicaid. Who gets Medicaid under the expansion is interesting. Right now, Medicaid is mostly a program for children and moms. This would expand it to adults who don't have kids, basically, which is a large group.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, John Dorschner from the Miami Herald, also with us Hannah Sampson from the Herald, both business writers. We'll be talking to Hannah about some other stuff a bit later on. And David Royce is with the News Service of Florida from Tallahassee. And so we talk about state issues and we get ready for a big town hall meeting on Monday. But I want to open this up to listeners through our the Public Insight Network this week and some other folks that we heard from. So we'll talk to Julio, who is on the line with us from Miami. Julio is with us on the Florida Roundup. Hi, good afternoon. Good to have you.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me on the air. I was happy to hear Governor Scott decided to support Medicaid expansion, you know, for a million of Floridians in this state, for people like my father. You know, like many of those who now qualify for health care, he's a tremendously hard worker, and he pays hundreds each month on treatments that would otherwise be spent on stimulating our local economy. So my question is, if the legislature decides to go against Scott, in popular opinion, and deny coverage for a million Floridians and leave millions of job-creating dollars on the table, what's the alternative for people like my father to get affordable health care?
Well, an interesting question is whether or not the legislature will go along, and that's one we raised. David, do you think the legislature is keen to follow along here?
I think there's, for the same pragmatic reasons as Governor Scott mentioned, I think there is some interest in the Senate. The question is in the House. House Speaker Will Weatherford has already talked about not being skeptical about this and not knowing whether or not the long-term money is there to cover it. You know, Governor Scott clearly has seen some sort of polling that tells him that there is probably a good reason to do this. And Julio's question, you know, he talks about public opinion being in favor of this. And I think there's probably something to that. And that might be one of the reasons Governor Scott was more willing to you know, to sort of make this move. Now, whether the legislature goes along with him is the big question. You know, I think he's going to get criticism from members of the House who, you know, run in pretty small districts where that are drawn, you know, so that a lot of the people who live in those districts tend to agree with them, tend to be more conservative. And so Republicans in the House probably are going to say, you know, I don't think we have enough money to do this in the long term. And the question is, you know, how do the numbers work out and whether or not they, you know, whether or not they go along with the governor.
And John, the second half of his question, if the legislature declines this kind of coverage, what are the proposals out there to ensure Floridians who are below the federal poverty line?
Well, it gets kind of messy. There will be health exchanges set up in the fall starting next year in which Floridians can purchase insurance on the individual market without concern about pre-existing conditions. There will be some kind of subsidies for that. Whether the poor would be destined for Medicaid can qualify or pay for those exchange costs remains to be seen.
All right, another call comes from Jimmy, who is in Hialeah. Jimmy, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Jimmy, you with us?
Yes, hi, thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, why are you making it harder for Florida Medicaid recipients to access health care services at the cost of creating numerous, creating red tape and affecting the health of cancer patients? The ones that lose the most are those that are newly diagnosed with a malignancy. Your new private managed care programs need to pay special attention to cancer patients and make sure you give them unprecedented access to their specialists and life-saving medicines. It is a terrible thing to live in the United States and not have access to the standard of care for cancer patients.
So why would that change, though, under this Medicaid expansion? Maybe I should ask John that.
Well,
John's got an answer.
Well, I think he's going a step further. He's looking at the HMOs, which are scheduled to come in with state Medicaid reform next year. And that is a concern. The concern is whether the HMO is going to stop patients from getting treatment with specialists, and that's something that has to be watched carefully.
All right, Jimmy.
It's happening even now as we talk, even with the pilot programs that have been launched in recent months.
Right. So what you're saying is the end result of what you'll be getting is worse than what you have right now.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm sure there's going to be tons of follow-up on this, Jimmy, and continue to listen to us. And as we, I'm sure that's hashed out. But you know, we're putting a cap on this, John, on the segment at least. Does this mean that we've moved past the acceptance of the Obamacare? That what are other changes that we're going to see with Obamacare now, with the federal ACA kicking in?
Well, the main thing is all the main stuff starts next year, and the main thing is the health exchanges, and that is pooling people in a group rather than purchasing individually, and they no longer, many uninsured people now are denied care because of the pre-existing conditions, and that's going to stop next year. That'll be a major change.
All right. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. Standing by patiently, Hannah Sampson with the Miami Herald, and she's going to talk to us about some stuff when we come back. We'll continue our discussion about state issues. John Dorschner also with us from the Herald, and via the ISDN line, as we call it, from Tallahassee, is David Royce from News Service of Florida. We'll be back to continue the discussion and open new topics in just a moment. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup. Welcome back. I'm Phil Latzman. Want to remind you that it's a two-way street. Your questions are welcome. You can email us with your first name and location to thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. And our phone lines, if we have some time to get some more calls in, it's 800-743-WLRN. You can also tweet us at @WLRN. I'm at Phil Latzman. John, I know you have a Twitter handle, and you've been using it even as you head into the final days at the Herald.
Miami Healthcare.
Easy to remember. Hannah B. Sampson. That's an easy one because you're a prolific tweeter.
Yes.
You want to spell that for everybody?
Hannah B. Sampson, H-A-N-N-A-H-B, as in boy, Sampson, S-A-M-P-S-O-N.
David, I looked for yours. Do you have a Twitter account yet, David Royce?
At News Service Florida.
At News Service Florida. That's what I thought. Okay, good. So we'll get into the sequestration stuff because it is all the rage, of course, in Washington right now. This manufactured crisis involving the budget. And there are going to be, if this kicks in, some specific impacts on the state of Florida. And one of the first things, Hannah, that is being talked about is its impact on the travel industry, perhaps the tourism industry here in South Florida. What are the sources that you're talking to telling you?
Yeah, I'm getting some emails from alarmed people who are saying this could... For Miami, which relies so heavily on tourism and South Florida in general, you really don't want people having to wait for longer at the airport. And you don't want the hassle of flying being more difficult than it already is. And what MIA told me today was that they're preparing like they would for peak holiday periods. So they're preparing that if TSA and CPB, some of those federal agencies, are affected, that they would have additional staff on hand to help out with the long lines, and they would tell people get there earlier. These are not good things for a destination that gets the majority of their tourists via air.
And here an example of that, Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Secretary, was in Miami on Wednesday at MIA. She tells the Herald that these budget cuts could be a customs nightmare. Already low-staffed, new customs officers wouldn't be able to be hired. Current customs agents may face furloughs, and who knows what could make its way across the border, right?
Yeah, and Miami relies very heavily on international travelers. And when people are either coming through Miami and risking that they're going to miss their connecting flight, which happens on a very regular basis, that's a reputation that they don't want to have, and they certainly don't want it to get worse.
And also, according to Florida Today, more than 12,000 civilians at Florida military installations could be furloughed unless Congress acts. About 30,000 defense-related private sector jobs in Florida could also be lost. Dave Royce, what's the talk in Tallahassee?
Yeah, that puts Florida among the top two or three states in the nation in terms of the effect because of the number of military installations throughout the state, from huge ones like Eglin Air Force Base up here in the Panhandle, to Patrick Air Force Base over in Melbourne and the commands like Central Command in the Tampa Bay area, MacDill. Thousands and thousands of jobs. And if there are furloughs of, particularly contractors, that has a ripple effect through the economy. And something that I think a lot of people don't realize is the number of defense contractors in Florida, particularly around the Space Coast area and Orlando. Orlando to Melbourne, there are a whole lot of defense contractors. And that's one of the first things that dries up under sequestration cuts, some of that military spending. And, that could have a big effect on those areas.
And we were just talking about public hospitals, John. This could also have a big impact on those.
Well, the Florida Hospital Association is estimating that in just Dade and Broward, the hospitals would lose maybe $350 million in sequestration. Most of that's coming in Medicare cuts. So,
And that's in a per year or just a
I'm
total,
not
or?
I'm actually I've I'm not clear what the time frame is on those estimates. I've asked the FHA for that and they haven't got back to me yet.
All right, so now the blame game, of course, is well, it's been going on, it's continuing. Here's a freshman Miami-based Democratic Congressman Joe Garcia just got to Washington D.C. says the impacts would be devastating and that it's the Republicans' fault.
People who live in South Florida, we've already gone through four tough years. The last thing we need is a government getting in the way of what is a weak recovery, but nonetheless a recovery. The president was clear. He was willing to look at entitlement reform. That's a huge step for Democrats. But where's the response? Where are the Republicans?
And we've heard the Senator Marco Rubio, who's currently in Israel this week, by the way, blaming President Obama. We hear Republicans blaming the president blaming the Congress. Obviously, it's they're both to blame on this. And PolitiFact, in fact, ruled half true. Dave Royce, what's the view up there in the Capitol about who's to blame for this?
Predictably, Republicans are in the majority here in the Capitol, and they obviously think that the Democrats are to blame, and vice versa. I mean, that's natural. The state has worries about the ripple effect as well, because in addition to when federal cuts, we talked about defense and we talked about the traveler, the TSA and that kind of thing, but these cuts are pretty they're all over the place. Their education, their workforce training programs, and the state often ends up sort of trying to pick up the costs when the federal government, when there are federal cuts, the state often steps in. And, the state has to balance its budget every year, and they already have a tough time doing that. And there's some worry up here in Tallahassee that the ripple impact comes down into the state budget and makes for a tough budget year here, because this would be, starting in March.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. It's David Royce from the News Service of Florida, also with us here in Miami, are Hannah Sampson and John Dorschner of the Miami Herald. I'm Phil Latzman. We also, and I forgot to mention this, we do have our live blog working, the online discussion happening even after we go off the air, hosted by our very hardworking social media editor, Danny Rivero, and that discussion is taking place on our website, WLRN.org, or also on our Facebook page. It's the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Do take part in that, and certainly there'll be more to talk about even after the show airs this afternoon or morning if you're listening on Saturday. So, and also to lead us up to our town hall, let's throw in another plug for that because it's a really important event. We're almost there. Our producer, Elaine Chen, tells us we're over 800 RSVPs. We're trying to get to over 1,000 by the weekend. This might be inside baseball talk, but we want you to show up and fill the house and tell these legislators how you feel about it. They can take that message to Tallahassee. We're trying to bring Tallahassee to you as much as possible. Again, this is Monday at 6:30 at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts, and I'll be hosting this, so we'll have all of our staffers, a couple of state legislators, the Herald's Tallahassee Bureau Chief, and it's your chance to get your message heard about the way state government affects us here in South Florida. Monday, February 25th, this coming Monday at 6:30 p.m., do right now, if you can, go to WLRN.org and RSVP. It is a free event that is taking place, and a very important one. And another key touchstone in President Obama's State of the Union last week was increasing the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. That has also been a big topic of discussion in D.C. among Florida lawmakers. Here is Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart of Miami.
How does that help grow the economy? It doesn't matter what the minimum wage is if you don't have a job, if there are no jobs, and that's the problem we have.
Democrat Alcee Hastings of Miramar, of course, has a different opinion, but says it's DOA anyway in the GOP-controlled House.
Well, first off, they aren't going to even bring it up. That's the regrettable part. And the second thing is, most of them don't understand a damn thing about poverty.
So, John Dorschner, you've been writing about business and economy for a long time. The minimum wage in Florida has never been above, I don't think, the federal minimum wage, and there's no sign that it will actually ever be that, and that state leaders don't seem to agree that it needs to be $9 an hour.
Well, going back to my economics classes in college, or quite a long time ago, is that minimum wage is kind of a false issue. It's a lot of economists... even those moderate or liberal, question how much it actually does, because it is a supply and demand market. If there is a demand for workers, they're going to pay more. So I find this a little bit of a political
Football. And Hanna, you know, in your business where you cover travel and tourism primarily, a lot of these people that work in the business are relying on tips. They're not necessarily, maybe are making minimum wage, but certainly not making a lot of money. So this would be a pretty big impact here in Florida, South Florida, especially if something like this were to go through.
Yeah. For a lot of the tourism industry, it would be probably a big boon for those workers.
It would be a boon for the workers, but would it be good for the travel and tourism industry in general?
Probably not so much.
Right. All right. So also, and this is something we'll direct towards Dave Royce, but this week there was a state house panel in Tallahassee that passed a bill that prevents cities and counties from enacting minimum wage ordinances stricter than state or federal levels. The bill passed on a party line vote in the House Local and Federal Affairs Committee on Wednesday. And in fact, the News Service of Florida sent this bite from Representative Steve Precourt, who's an Orlando Republican who was the sponsor.
This bill is intended to say that we should have one discussion on this at the state level. So we're going to, as a first step towards that, preempt local governments from having the authority to move down the road towards this.
So Florida, Dave, doesn't go above the minimum wage. State leaders want to control it so that local and county governments aren't able to raise it on their own. Sounds a little inequitable. They're trying to say that it should be uniform minimum wage, whether you're in Ocala or Pensacola or Miami or West Palm Beach. Is that what that means?
Right. Yes. And I think that anybody who knows labor markets knows they're not the same. That's a good example. Ocala and Miami. I mean, you know, if you move somewhere with a higher cost of living, the wage scales tend to be higher. And yet we do have a uniform minimum wage. And then for background, you know, cities and counties have not been able to allow a higher minimum wage for the general public for a long time. This bill would extend that to say that city and county governments can't pay their own employees, can't have a higher minimum wage standard when it comes to things like contracting. You know, if they're gonna say, well, if anybody's gonna do business with the city, they have to pay higher than the minimum wage. They wouldn't be able to do that under this bill. But you're right. I mean, you know, a statewide wage is not completely realistic.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. You are welcome to join the conversation. You can we'll sneak in a phone call in just a moment, but if you've got something on your mind, 800-743-WLRN is how you'd reach us during the show, 800-743-9576. We're tweetable at WLRN, and, of course, our live discussion being hosted on our website, WLRN.org, and on our Facebook page. Let's take a quick call from David, who is in Palm Beach County. David, welcome to the Florida Roundup. What's on your mind, sir?
Oh, good afternoon. I'm one of the South Floridians who's worried about the public safety issues that are in Tallahassee right now, and if the panel can give me some update or insight, I'd appreciate it on three items. Number one, traffic signals, people going through the traffic signals, but the red light cameras in place.
Red light cameras, okay.
I understand that there's a representative from the Miami area who is trying to stop those red light cameras from being installed and to eradicate them, and she was revealed in the Miami Herald as having a husband who's already been arrested or stopped five times for going through red lights.
Hmm. Well, let's take that one, David, to stay right there. Dave Royce, status
sure.
of that particular red light cameras.
He's speaking of Representative Daphne Campbell, a Democrat from Miami, and as he mentioned, the Herald did report that her husband's car has been on a few of those red light camera pictures. But this is a couple of years ago, the state put in place a law that says cities and counties, local governments can put up these red light cameras, and they set out the way that the money is collected and what it goes to fund, which John could probably actually talk about that too, because I think part of it goes to trauma centers. And the law has been extremely unpopular. And there was a repeal effort filed almost as soon as Governor Scott signed that bill. They've had a repeal effort every year for the last few years, and this year is no different. The people against it tend to be sort of take the libertarian tack that, you know, that the more Big Brother is not the way to address the red light running problem. But there's also a constitutional question about whether or not people who end up with these tickets should have the right to confront a police officer in court who would have to testify, yeah, I did see, you know, under the totality of the circumstances, this person run a red light. So there's all kinds of questions about these, but they're huge, huge moneymakers for city and counties. And the cities and counties aren't going to let these go away easily. And also, it's a public safety question. I mean, there are differing studies about whether or not these are effective in preventing deaths and injuries at intersections. So, you know, sort of a he said, she said thing about whether that is the case. But the public safety community, firefighters, police officers, tend to be in favor of keeping these things. They say they make intersections safer.
And David, I know you wanted to ask also about the texting and driving bans and gun control possible legislation.
I did. The texting laws are up. I mean, the bills are up there again for the fourth or fifth year in a row. And I understand that it actually one made it through a committee with some amendment that allowed texting if you're stopped in the middle of an intersection, which I think is ridiculous. But I'd like to know what the members of the panel think the success will be this year of finally getting a texting bill for public safety purposes again. Well, and as to the as to the guns.
Quickly, yeah.
The Sun Sentinel ran an article the other day demanding that the legislature consider letting cities themselves impose restrictions on where concealed carry can be brought to parks, ball fields, theaters, churches, and things such as that. We have Big Brother up in Tallahassee run by mostly rural legislators trying to preclude us from having local control here in South Florida where the risk is much higher.
All right, let's ask David. I appreciate your call, David. Dave Royce, about those two things. It sounds like from what I've heard, not much would happen on either texting or gun control.
Very quickly, I think you're right on gun control. Not much is likely to happen. This is a very a fairly pro-gun legislature, and I don't think we're going to see any new gun control. Even in the wake of the Newtown school shooting, there's no serious talk about any new gun control in Tallahassee. On the texting, however, I would say that there may be you might be surprised. I think that this is one of those things that there is a growing change in opinion. Florida is one of, I think, one of only maybe one or two states in the whole country that doesn't have some sort of texting ban. And I think just from what I hear around the legislature, I think that might actually gain some traction. I'm not sure if they'll pass something this year, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it pass in the next year or two.
Hannah, quickly from you, what as a in your beat, what would you think that the people you cover want to hear coming from Tallahassee this upcoming session?
You know, all of these things about minimum wage and basic labor issues, health care, all of that's going to be important. There are things that are at a federal level, like waits for visas from very important countries that not necessarily in this session, but that people down here definitely have their eyes on and are waiting for more movement on.
That's Hannah Sampson with the Miami Herald. She is also with us with John Dorschner from the Herald here in the studio, and Dave Royce joining us from Tallahassee from the News Service of Florida. I've got a couple other things that we want to talk about that we may or may not have time to get into too heavily. We did want to talk about the some local stories and what's going on at the University of Miami this week, which is significant as they fight against the NCAA, and also some other travel and tourism issues with Hannah. We got the Food and Wine Festival coming up this weekend, and John Dorschner, it's his final week coming up at the Miami Herald. He'll tell us what he remembers about 40 years covering South Florida news. You'll want to wait for that as we come back and continue our discussion in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Hope you're enjoying the discussion. And again, we're going to have a discussion on state issues most important to you here in South Florida and throughout the state. We're doing this Monday, our town hall meeting. You still have time to RSVP for free at WLRN.org for that. Also join our online discussion at WLRN.org right now on all the issues we've discussed on this program. Here again with John Dorschner and Hannah Sampson from the Herald, Dave Royce from the News Service of Florida. One other state issue that we didn't get to, but just bears a mention here. State Senator Eleanor Sobel had planned to introduce a bill this week to give rights enjoyed by married couples to those in domestic partnerships as well. The Hollywood Democrat says her bill would have given unmarried couples, gay or straight, such rights as visiting their partners in the hospital.
This bill is not about getting married. This is about civil union, about registries, about a lot of people who would benefit from equal protection under the law.
But, of course, we hear, the Floridians, the opponents say that it runs afoul of the constitutional ban on gay marriage passed in Florida in 2008. Dave, she never actually got a chance to introduce this bill. What happened?
Well, it was referred to her committee. She's one of the few Democrats, one of only a couple of Democrats who actually chair a committee up here. So it was on her committee agenda to get a hearing, and they did have a hearing. They heard testimony, but the bill was going to go down in that committee. If they'd gotten to a vote, it would have been defeated. Republicans have an overwhelming majority in both the Senate and the House in the legislature, and that means they have a majority on all the committees. Even when a Democrat, as is the case with this one, is a chairman, which is unusual, that bill was going to fail in that committee, and you could tell based on what people were saying, what legislators on the committee were saying in debate. And so she pulled the bill from consideration. She says she's going to try to make some changes to it, but the basic problem is for that issue, it's not going to pass in Tallahassee. Again, overwhelmingly Republican legislature. A lot of conservatives don't like the idea. They say it's essentially an end run, as you alluded to, around the Defense of Marriage Act. And so, I don't think no matter what she does to that bill, if the core principle is there, it's going to have a hard time passing in Tallahassee.
It's interesting. It was only 4 years ago that constitutional amendment passed 62% here in the state of Florida in 2008. Mm-hmm. Do you think that public opinion has changed since then? Now we've seen other states, now 9 states, I think, have legalized some form of same-sex marriage. You think if they took that vote again, we might have a different result?
Could be, and I do think public opinion on this issue has changed fairly dramatically if you look at it over the long term, and certainly nationally it has changed. But, the makeup of the legislature lags changes in the general sense of opinion. It usually lags by a few years. Interestingly, Florida, the legislature has 2 openly gay lawmakers this year just elected mm-hmm. for the first time. That's something that 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I first started covering the legislature, you wouldn't have imagined.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup. But we'll move on to some state, local stuff, rather. And the big story this week here in South Florida, at least, really almost all over the news, is the probe is over at the University of Miami. The charges have been officially leveled against the UM athletic program. Of course, the NCAA has had to admit to an ethical breach of their own during this process. This apparently is the old lack of institutional control, which could lead to the program being shut down. But that is unlikely. Now the UM's president, Donna Shalala, says they take full responsibility, but she wonders if they're actually based on facts, since these accusations come from the former booster and convicted Ponzi schemer Nevin Shapiro. So, Hannah, you are a University of Miami alum. We spent some time on the campus this week just talking to some students about how they feel about this. Students, teachers, everybody seems to think that there's just major hypocrisy taking place from the NCAA, especially down here in South Florida.
Well, and my expertise comes from my status as
you're a little bit biased.
As someone who finished paying off my student loans to the University of Miami only in the last few years. So I was actually on campus at the basketball game this week that they won by a squeaker as the news was coming out about the NCAA charges. So there were many levels of tension in the Bank United Center. And, I think from what I could gauge from the students and other alum was that they were pretty impressed with Donna Shalala's feisty response and kind of cheering for that. But speaking from someone who attended there, I think there's also a feeling that we want them to go through the process. We would like them to go through a fair process and get the punishment that they are due and kind of put this behind us. And, the reputation of the University of Miami over the years has been one that has not been squeaky clean. So I think we would like to move into a new era of reputation for UM.
Boy, Donna Shalala versus the NCAA, that's a heavyweight battle there. Of course, the UM calling for the investigation to be dropped. But Donna Shalala said this week the university, quote, had been wronged. She called for closure with no additional punitive measures. And, of course, they've already given up three postseason games, two bowl games, some athletic scholarships. And John, you've been covering – you're a big sports fan at the same time, but you've been covering University of Miami or haven't seen what's gone on at University of Miami over the years. How does this compare to the past?
I just get astounded about the regulations in college sports. There are places like the University of Alabama – where the coach earns millions of dollars a year, but it is absolutely illegal to give a student athlete a penny. The regulations, they cover volumes and volumes. These programs make millions upon millions for the universities, but then the limitations for the amateur athlete, it just to me is just one big mess.
And speaking of messes, the NCAA acknowledges that it had its ethical breach. It improperly paid the attorney for former booster Nevin Shapiro $19,000 for information in the case. They essentially used Maria Elena Perez's subpoena power to depose witnesses. That is a no-no. So in a conference call, NCAA President Mark Emmert said any evidence gathered in that manner would not be used against UM and called it a self-inflicted black eye.
This is something that is an embarrassment to the association and our staff. It's something that is contrary to all of the activities and directions that we've been engaged with and all the things that we espouse.
So the word, the name Mark Emmert, Hannah, and for that matter, Nevin Shapiro, never to be uttered on the University of Miami campus.
It's like Voldemort. You just don't say that name. Yeah.
And one other sports-related, now this is one of those weeks where we had a couple of crossover stories. This got a lot of attention in Boca Raton. Florida Atlantic has named its new stadium. Now, we're still waiting for naming rights for the Marlins. We still have Marlins Park, and I guess they kind of lost the mojo on that with all the trading away of the players. But the FAU did get their naming rights this week for their new stadium in Boca Raton, just opened about a year ago. It's named after a prison, private prison corporation, GEO Group. And that has spurred many people to come up with nicknames already. Owl Catraz seems to be the most popular one. And we're also seeing maybe possibly the company is some questionable human rights issues, but this is certainly unorthodox, John, to have a stadium naming from a private prison company?
Well, it's unorthodox, but once again, big bucks and college athletes. And so, you know, they're taking big bucks and people can go tisk tisk, but it's just part of the big mess.
$6 million over 12 years for the GEO Group in Boca Raton for that new stadium. And I guess the names and the jokes continue. The big weekend on South Beach, where we had the Today Show here, the NBC's all over us, picture postcard for 4 hours of video on South Beach, the Food and Wine Festival. Hannah, how big has this event come? It's huge now.
It is. It's in its 12th year, and it's certainly mushroomed over its history. I think they're expecting about 60,000 people this year. About a third of them are from out of town, and these are people who are not coming in and staying at the budget hotel. These are people who are able to drop a few hundred dollars for a ticket to get, you know, a bunch of barbecue and bubbly. So. For hotels, it means that they're paying really top room rates. They're packing South Beach, spilling over into downtown. And the event really, it's called the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, but it is spread beyond South Beach. It stretches into Miami. I'm covering an event at Marlins Park in the city of Miami over the weekend. So it's very large, and it happens at a time when Miami is already overflowing with tourists because, as you saw on the Today Show this morning, all the hosts were sitting there by the pool with the sunshine, and at the bottom of the screen was the crawl announcing the latest winter storm that's going to dump snow, you know, everywhere else. So, you know, it's a good time to be in Miami.
It's the height of the season, and this is your beat. Seems like things are doing pretty well. How we doing?
Well,
number one industry in the state.
Judging by how difficult it is for me to get anywhere on the weekend because I live in Miami Beach, they're doing well. Maybe that's not so great for me, but I talk to local hotels all the time, and they say that, for example, over President's Day weekend, which is a huge weekend with multiple warring events, some of the hotels that I talked to said they were booked fully for the first time ever. The 400-room hotel completely sold out at rates that were some 20% higher than a year ago. So Florida, Miami tourism has been increasing over the last few years. It's maybe not increasing at such huge levels across the board every year now, because once you're already so on the top of your game, it's difficult to get huge right. jumps. But, you know, it still seems to be an industry that's really leading the way for us.
And then we talk about the chances of the referendum on the Dolphin Stadium improvements. And one of the things that, that skeptics have said about this is that, well, so much is already going on here during the winter. Who needs a Super Bowl? I mean, could you ever have thought a time in our history that we could say, who needs the Super Bowl because there's so many other things happening here?
Yeah, I don't know how many people are saying that, because I know that there are people who definitely love the rates that the Super Bowl can draw too, and the exposure. But it's true. I mean, it is a very packed schedule in South Florida at the time when the Super Bowl happens. So, you know, I'm sure it's the dream of the tourism boosters everywhere around here.
And you, you've also spent a lot of time covering Carnival's troubles, the Miami-based cruise line, and the cruise ship that was stuck in the Gulf of Mexico last week. I don't have to repeat this because it's been overcovered as it is, but the Carnival, has it taken a hit?
I mean, it's definitely taken a hit to its reputation. The nonstop CNN coverage was exactly the opposite of the Today Show in Miami for Food and Wine. You know, it's exactly what you don't want for your company. It's coming at a time of year when they get a lot of their bookings for the later parts of the year. So the timing in every possible way is very bad for them. Experts seem to say that, you know, they'll bounce back from this. They always have from previous issues, but it's not good for the industry in general. For Carnival, it was a huge black eye that lasted for a very long time.
And we're going to cap it off with John Dorsner, sort of our tribute. Now, we're going to record something next week, officially saying goodbye to John. He's done a lot of radio work with us over the years in our partnership. You've been at the Herald for how long now, John?
Almost 43 years.
43 years. And of all the things you've covered, and we talk about you being the preeminent expert on healthcare, nobody does that better. What has stood out over the years in your 43 years? Next week, you're going to be retiring.
Yeah, well, a lot of things. I spent quite a bit of time with the old Sunday magazine, Tropic, mm-hmm. and did a lot of traveling with them, did a lot of things, Casablanca, the Caribbean. There is a lot of drug deals, drug stories.
I quickly tell that one because you remember this week, by the way, we heard about a $17 million cocaine bust in Miami Beach, a pot grower shootout in Kendall. The drug wars are back in South Florida, and maybe knowing that you remember those days.
Well, what made big news with the Coast Guard was the seizure of 1,400 pounds of cocaine, and that's about two-thirds of a ton. And there was a time back in the 80s when I had advanced warning and could go on a raid involving 1.9 tons of cocaine. And the Herald had a multi-ton policy, and they decided 2 tons was multi-tons, so 1.9 tons did not even get a brief in the Miami Herald.
And so, boy, see how times have changed. That was a routine event to see 2 tons of cocaine wash up on shore.
Yeah.
Amazing. And John, we're going to, again, officially say goodbye next week. Thank you for all the work you've done, though, on the radio side with us. It's been great. We'll miss you. What are you working on for your last story?
Well, it's going to be a look at Jackson and where Jackson stands and the problems of the future. So that'll be it.
Well, you'll be missed. And Hannah, what are you working on? You're doing Food and Wine Festival, right?
That's my weekend work. There's some hotel news. There's some museum stuff I'll be writing about next week, some other hotel news, and inevitably some more Carnival stories.
And Dave, great to have you on, too. Dave Royce from the News Service of Florida. Very quickly, what are you working on for next week?
The legislature starts officially a week from Tuesday, but I mean, it's been going on in terms of committees, but the State of the State from Governor Scott is a week from Tuesday, and floor sessions begin that day. So 2 months of nonstop legislative floor coverage.
And we are trying to bring Tallahassee to you. We have our town hall meeting on Monday. And again, we want you to RSVP at WLRN.org, show up, ask your lawmakers, ask the reporters. There's going to be a whole bunch of other things that are going on surrounding this event. It is an exercise in civic engagement. Again, show them that you care. Go to the WLRN website, RSVP, and we'll see you there Monday at 6 o'clock. That does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, February 22nd, 2013. Thanks to our panelists. Another great show. And if you missed any of it, you can listen back on Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. We also post it at WLRN.org. Florida Roundup produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Elaine Chen, our associate producer, working very hard on our town hall activities and on this program. Thank you. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Our social media editor, Danny Rivero. Our executive producers, Peter J. Meritz and Dan Gretsch. Technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. If it's Friday, it's only a game on Saturday. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida. Thanks for listening.